One Year by عادل شرقاوي. One year behind bars. I missed at least 365 kisses from Khawla. Countless family gatherings. Foods I never touched. Sleepless nights. Endless snow and endless stress. Long summer days and sunsets that lost their charm. And it goes on. Hearing the same words over and over again. National security before individual rights. It's no criminal case, it's immigration. Prove your innocence and we'll let you go.
How? How when charges are secret, informers anonymous, and all evidence hidden? Right of appeal? That's only for criminals. Is presumption of innocence reserved for sponsorship scandals? Isn't the same Coderre involved there? Has Inquisition and Citizenship Canada ever heard of the Charter?
Tonight, one more time, a two-year-old girl will sleep without her father, and the baby, 9 months old, will be missing his dad. Ask yourself why.
Mona El-Fouli, the wife of Mohamed Majoub, has been the sole provider and sole parent for her children for the last 4.5 years since her husband's imprisonment. She speaks about the economic and emotional suffering that her family has experienced.
My husband was going to work on the 26th January 2000. And he was leaving the street car to cross the street to go to his work. And he found out that he was surrounded with machine guns and cameras and policemen and so on. And at the beginning, he thought it was for drug, like trying to catch a drug person or something. And then he found out it was for him. And he didn't learn why he was taken until I heard it in the news and read it in the newspaper, and I told him about it. And since then, he's still detained at West Detention Center. Now it's over 4 years, and without any charges, without any evidence, and without any trial. I believe people are innocent until they're proven guilty. In this case, people are guilty until they're proven innocent. I believe that if they have anything against him, they wouldn't hesitate to show it. They already put him in a very bad position in the media, that he's a suspected terrorist and he's this and that. And again, they have no evidence whatsoever to show. Because if they have any, they would have shown it to everybody. It's very difficult. I'm sure people must have read the newspapers and listened to the news about what he was going through in jail, like all kinds of abuse. Even one of the judges was saying it's more like Guantanamo Bay, but it's in Canada. Abuses, verbally, attempt of physical abuse, sexual abuse, and you know my husband had became sick with hepatitis C, and he developed that in jail, and until now he didn't get any treatment for it. He had injured his knee in there. He needs an operation and needs to see a specialist for his knee, and until now there is no treatment or not even to see a specialist. He's losing his sight while he was reading, and until now there is no doctor to prescribe glasses or to see what his sight level is. Again, it's all kind of the bribing of all basic rights. I believe this is completely against human rights. My husband was the provider of the family, and he's been taken away. So it's really affecting us financially, besides emotionally too. You know, the children are very, very, very anxious to be able to touch their dad, to be able to play with him, to be able to talk, to see him, and stay with him. They're depriving them from their childhood with their dad. They're depriving even him from being with his children without any evidence, without any charges, you see. You know, my children are often asking me, can we touch him? Why is he not out? We need him. We want to play with him. And one time, one of my children was saying, Mom, I want to write a letter to Dad. Can you help me? Okay, I'm going to tell you when you write. Daddy, I love you so much. I want to be with you. I'm going to bring all my toys and come and play with you, but I would never leave you again, ever, ever, ever. And another time was asking me, how long is he going to stay there? When they're going to get him out? You know, if they don't get him out, they might as well take me in. And things like that. And sometimes he would just sit there and cry and scream, just wanting his dad. And since my husband has been taken, my 7-year-old, he started to have separation and anxiety. So you can see how much it's really affecting the family. And it's all burden on my shoulders. I'm the mother, I'm the father, I'm trying to comfort the children, I'm trying to comfort him, and like I'm handling everything. It's kind of too much for me. Over what? Over nothing, because they don't show any evidence at all. And they don't even allow their lawyers to see the evidence and to be able to defend him if they have any. Is this part of the human rights? This is completely against human rights. I believe the most criminal person in the whole world have the right to see their evidence and have a right to a fair trial. And they don't give that. Is this part of the democracy? You know, I'd like to add to this, to the people who are listening to this issue. I want to tell them, try to educate yourself in these issues and others, and try not to be as a stereotype, not to listen to the news and take it as it is, because it's always not true. Try to educate yourself and use your common sense and use your intelligence in these issues, and don't just take it and follow it, because I always have discrimination just because of this issue.
Members of targeted communities in Canada have responded to the security certificate detentions with shock and fear and disbelief that this is happening in a country that is supposed to respect human rights and due process. Mary Foster talks about the pressure felt by Muslim community members and the response of Canadians in general to the arrest and detention of Adil Sharkawi.
Here in Montreal, there was a community meeting immediately after he was arrested. There was a huge turnout, and there's been support for him from different organizations and individuals in the Muslim and Arab communities here. However, at the same time, people are afraid, and there has been kind of a suspicious pattern of people coming forward to offer tangible support and then backing out afterwards. And we suspect what's happening is that they're getting approached by CSIS and being threatened that something bad is going to happen to them. And feeling vulnerable, many people give in to that pressure, understandably. There's been both sides a great deal of concerns, and then at the same time, people backing off and feeling afraid. The big organizations and some unions have been very concerned as well about what's happening. Other communities, it's hard to get people moving on this, and I'm not sure whether it's because people are afraid. People partly buy into the argument of, oh, well, we'll abuse the rights of a few people if that helps us in this so-called fight against terrorism, not realizing that it doesn't help. It's probably counterproductive. Or whether people are just overwhelmed by the pace of what's happening and the difficulty to combat it. I mean, there's maybe that sense of not having a power to effectively combat that cynicism and apathy is holding people back. Typically, when I talk to individuals about it, they haven't heard about it. Maybe that we're not doing our job very well, but also that the media is not doing its job, or it's doing it, but it's not the job that it pretends to have. But at the same time, when they do hear about it, they're typically very shocked and disturbed that people can be locked up in these conditions and that Canada is considering deporting people even when there's a clear risk of torture.
The color line is the power line, is the poverty line.
Riyad Suluji is the executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations in Canada, a national grassroots organization that does media relations, mediation of human rights complaints, and public advocacy around discrimination against Muslim communities in Canada. He discusses the increased racial profiling of Muslims and Arabs by CSIS, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, and how the security certificate arrests and heightened levels of detainment for interrogation have created feelings of insecurity and alarm within the community.
Discrimination and exploitation feed into each other today under global capitalism.
To set the stage, post 9/11, there's been a lot of security visitations with the Muslim community and a host of these security certificate cases. There's a strong feeling among the Arab and Muslim community, and I think the broader human rights community, that the security certificate process is a very non-transparent process that violates the rule of law. And I think that it's really on that basis that we've become involved in these cases, because the entire process is a very problematic process, doesn't allow individuals to have a fair trial. And what's very troubling about these processes is the standard of the evidence that is being used against individuals. The evidence typically comes from CSIS, for example. And CSIS has been quite clear and has made public statements of the fact that it gets and it garners much of its evidence from foreign governments. And many of those governments are actually governments that have very little by way of democratic traditions. And the way that those intelligence agencies within those governments and within those states operate is not transparent, is not accountable. There are no checks and balances. Much of that information is gleaned and garnered from those actors. And the first flag that should go up is really the credibility of that evidence. Much of that evidence tends to be very, very politicized. For example, I think it was admitted in the Arar inquiry that CSIS, you know, talks, discusses, and gets evidence from governments in the Middle East, knowing full well, for example, the litany of human rights abuses that occur there, and the fact that much of this evidence may well simply be politicized evidence or evidence that is not checked, that is not cross-examined. And it's really on the basis of evidence like that that a security certificate case begins to be developed. Evidence that is very sloppy, that would never be accepted in open court, but that is the exact sort of evidence that is used to justify taking the life and liberty away from an individual. One of the very troubling trends after 9/11 has been the way in which certain investigations or interrogations on the part of security agencies have been done. It's not necessarily problematic that Canadian Muslims and Arabs are regularly called upon by CSIS and the RCMP to do voluntary interviews, although those interviews have become very pervasive after September the 11th. It's very common now for activists and scholars, they are regularly approached by CSIS and the RCMP for information. What's been particularly troubling is the way in which those visitations are carried out and the tactics that are used. Some of those tactics are clearly unethical, and some of them border on the unconstitutional. For example, it's very common for Arabs and Muslims to be paid a visit by CSIS or the RCMP when they are at work. Intelligence officers have come to the place of work and spoken to the supervisor, and sometimes spoken, for example, to neighbors even. This creates a very chilling atmosphere because it's amply clear that this individual is being visited by CSIS and or the RCMP because they have questions about that individual, and it creates a very chilling atmosphere for people at their workplace. There's a cloud of suspicion that falls upon people, and this is what people have fighted to us after these interviews, that the environment between them and their coworkers is not the same after that. The other very common tactic, for example, is that people are told that they really should talk and they really should cooperate voluntarily, but they're also told that they don't need a lawyer. And in many cases, they're dissuaded actively from getting a lawyer. These sorts of voluntary interviews, there is no duty on the person to speak. It's a purely voluntary exercise. You know, you're not being charged with anything, and even if you are charged, of course, you don't have to speak. But in these cases, people are given the impression that there is evidence against them. One individual, for example, was told, well, you know, we found your name in a cave in Afghanistan, and therefore you have a lot to answer for, and you should really speak about that. And of course, if there's any evidence people are involved in anything tied to terrorism, they should be tried, charged, and prosecuted to the full extent of the law. But many of these tactics are used as sort of arm-twisting tactics, and then people are told, well, you don't need a lawyer. Why do you want a lawyer? Lawyers are very expensive. What do you have to hide that you need a lawyer? People are actively dissuaded from having legal representation, which is actually very important given the fact that some of these interviews typically wander into territory that is completely irrelevant, fishing expedition questions and even some witch hunt questions as well. I guess the long and the short of it is that given these security visitations, the feeling in the community is one of fear and one of anxiety. And if you add to that cases like Maher Arar and also other cases, and there have been a litany of those cases, it's not simply the Arar case, but there have been at least 3 or 4 Canadians who have been detained abroad and tortured. And in all of those cases, there are strong suggestions and in some cases, almost irrefutable evidence that CSIS and the RCMP was involved in one way or another. In the Arar case, for example, it's amply clear that the RCMP did not follow, and actually recently admitted it in the Garvey report, that the RCMP did not follow its own internal protocols in passing information to the United States, in accurately vetting that information, and so did in fact contribute to his predicament. We don't know the extent to which they were complicit, the extent to which they actually gave the thumbs up to the United States to deport him to Syria. But these cases, and there have been many of them, have really caused people, if you like, to live in the shadow of Maher Arar, fearful perhaps that what happened to him might very well happen to them. Since 9/11, the amount of racial profiling cases that we fielded, the cases, for example, where tactics were problematic, have been, I think, 15 or 20 of them. And that doesn't speak to, for example, the number of cases where people have been asked to meet with the RCMP and CSIS, which is much, much greater than that. But cases where there have been tactics that we consider to be troubling have been, I think, around 15 or 20. It's nearly impossible for people to come forward. It's very impossible, it's very difficult to get data on hate crimes in general. For example, one of the well-established numbers by hate crimes experts is that about 95% of hate crimes don't get reported for various reasons. People don't want to report it, don't have a culture of reporting it from where they come from, concerned about confidentiality, anonymity, and so forth. So fully about 95% of hate crimes don't get reported. And, I mean, I would suggest it's as much or probably even more when it's issues of profiling that involve the RCMP and CSIS. Most people don't want to come forward. But I think the fact that, you know, we do have 15 or 20 cases is indicative of a much more serious social problem that exists out there. One of the things we did after September the 11th is we decided to hold nationwide workshops. on two themes. One is legal literacy, and the other one was media relations engagement. So we did these grassroots workshops, over 30 of them from coast to coast in various cities, about how to engage the media constructively, what are the skills of doing that, and then also know your rights or legal literacy workshops. And the intent of that was that most Canadian Muslims and most Canadians as well really have no idea about what their rights are in Canada. It's not something which is taught at school. It's not something, actually, that is taught unless you go to law school. And so part of that education process was to create a Know Your Rights pocket guide. And it's a very succinct guide that's meant to fit in your wallet. And what it does is it highlights what people's essential fundamental rights are in various circumstances, in various situations. So there's a segment, for example, about know your rights at the workplace if you're discriminated against. Well, what do you do? What are your rights and what do you do and how do you seek to resolve that? If you're the subject of a hate crime, for example, if the RCMP and CSIS visit you, what are your rights in that circumstance? And we've distributed, I think, over 10,000 copies free across the country. It's been very, very well received because it's been a breath of fresh air in the sense that people who really didn't know about what their rights were now knew that there is a fairly impressive array of rights and freedoms in Canada, and that in many circumstances, the easiest way to resolve conflict or to mediate conflict is simply to know what your rights are. On a positive note, the Maher Arar case, and I think some of the other cases, have really created a great deal of public scrutiny and critical analysis about how human rights are being eroded, the prevalence of racial profiling. And that has been a wonderfully positive development. I mean, the Maher Arar is an unheard of case, I think, certainly in my work, and even, for example, I was told by an official at Amnesty in Canada that they've never seen a case that has gone from coast to coast like the Arar case, where there's been such a tremendous outpouring of national support among all Canadians. That has transcended the issue of that he was an Arab or that he was a Muslim, and has really been most fundamentally about the fact that he was a Canadian citizen, he was a human being who had his basic rights violated. So I think that case, and I think other cases, have generated a lot more public debate and a lot more public criticism and scrutiny about the gradual erosion of human rights or fundamental freedoms in Canada. And that's been a wonderfully positive development because it's also allowed like-minded groups to come together in solidarity, whereas before perhaps we were working in our own separate cloistered worlds. Now I think there's much more solidarity and much more group activism on these issues, which is wonderful to see. Back and forth.
They say that you can't come here, not in the light of day. Somebody has got plans for you, starve at home or hide away. Will we open up the borders, tear down the prison walls, declare that no one is illegal, watch the giant as it falls? So much travels across these borders. So much is bought.
The secret trial process has grave implications, not only for the men who are being detained, but for their families and communities, and also for the protection of civil liberties in general. Tune in next week for the second episode of this documentary called Not So Fundamental Rights: Security Certificates and Secret Trials in Canada. We will discuss the history of secret trials and the role of Canadian intelligence and security agencies in these detentions. We will also situate Canada's security legislation within the greater war on terror.
Watch the giant as it falls. Hear the stockholders cheering. The world's getting smaller. Hear the drowning child crying.
This documentary has been a CKUT long-term memory radio production.
Some whisper in the shadows while others count the dollars. Some have suits and ties, others chains and collars. Will we open up the borders, tear down the prison walls, declare that no one is illegal, watch the giant as it falls?